Blog Talk Radio.
Are we on? I imagine that we're on. Hello and welcome to Ethics Talk. We are broadcasting live from Onspaugh Hall, the basement of Onspaugh Hall in beautiful Mount Pleasant, Central Michigan University. My name is Dr. Hope May, and I am the director of the Center for Professional and Personal Ethics at Central Michigan University. And I'm also joined by three students who are with us today as well. And we have a really special show lined up. What I'm going to do in the procedure is that I'm going to just sort of set up the show, the background of the show, and we'll just start talking about the main topic, which is self-esteem and its relationship to academic integrity. But basically, what we're doing today, let me just tell you the names of the students that are here. We have Nicholas Brousseau. Say hello, Nick.
Hello.
We have Sandra Russell.
Hello.
And Emily Hagen.
Hello.
And we are here to talk about the ideas and the doctoral dissertation of Tal Ben-Shahar. And if you don't know who Tal Ben-Shahar is, I'm just going to give you a little bit of background about him. Tal Ben-Shahar is, I guess, best known as a positive psychologist. And if you're not sure what positive psychology is, I basically think it's best explained as a paradigm shift within psychology, that psychology has been traditionally focused on detecting, defining, and treating illness and disease. Positive psychology is a shift in focus, and so instead of being focused on illness and disease, people working within the framework of positive psychology are focused on positive traits, traits that conduce to well-being, happiness, flourishing, and the cultivation of those traits. So it's a paradigm shift, it's a shift of focus, because instead of focusing on the negative and trying to prevent it, positive psychologists are focused on the positive and are trying to cultivate it. Tal Ben-Shahar is known as a positive psychologist, and again, it's a very broad label that just encompasses research focused on positive traits and the cultivation thereof. But Tal Ben-Shahar has written a book called Happier, which is a New York Times best-selling book. He's also finishing a book called The Pursuit of Perfect. And but I think probably he achieved most notoriety around 2005-2006 when he was teaching a course at Harvard called Positive Psychology. And this course received a lot of national attention because it was the highest enrolled course at Harvard, I think, in its history, or if not, does anybody know?
Yeah, I think it was in its history. He was on the, if you YouTube him, you can see him talk, I think it's on CNN with somebody about the popularity of his class, and he was asked why he thought it was so popular. And if I recall correctly, it was because he thought that people weren't as interested in making money as they were about living a happy life or a fulfilling life. So.
Okay. And it was, I think like over 800 students signed up for this course. And it's changed lives. He changes the lives of his students. I consider him to be a master teacher. And actually, that is how I discovered him, was watching his lectures, which are unfortunately now no longer viewable. And if Dr. Shahar, Ben-Shahar, is listening to this, I want you to know that those lectures had a profound effect on me, and I think on some of my students. And we are in mid-Michigan at a, you know, at a public university here, and I don't think you're aware how powerful those lectures are, not only personally, but also in terms of pedagogy and things that I've learned about excellence in teaching. So I thank you for that, or anybody who knows Dr. Ben-Shahar. But in any case, we are talking about Tal's dissertation. I'm calling him Tal. I should call him Dr. Ben-Shahar. But I feel like I know him. we're talking about his dissertation, which was completed in 2004 at Harvard University. It's called Restoring Self-Esteem's Self-Esteem. And basically, we're talking about today two ideas. This is his own contribution. Dr. Ben-Shahar is making a distinction between two components of self-esteem. One component he calls dependent self-esteem. The other component is independent self-esteem. They are both components of self-esteem, but dependent self-esteem is when, and I should also say that self-esteem, in terms of self-esteem theory, and I'm pretty sure that Tal is basing this on the work of Bandura, but people who do self-esteem research make a distinction between worth and competence, that those are the two ingredients that comprise self-esteem. And dependent self-esteem is when your beliefs about your worth and competence are based on other people, what other people think of you, external standards. Whereas independent self-esteem, your judgments about your own worth and competence are coming from yourself. And a very powerful distinction, I'm pretty sure the way that I, and if anybody disagrees, but I'm pretty sure what Paul is saying, at least in the first part of the dissertation, is that both components are necessary, that you start with dependent self-esteem, and that's sort of like the developmental precondition, if you will, for independent self-esteem. Do you guys have anything to add to that, agree, disagree?
I don't know if it's exactly that, at least the way that I kind of thought about it, because I thought that dependent self-esteem was kind of this, they're both aspects of self-esteem, but I don't think that you start with dependent self-esteem to reach an independent self-esteem. I haven't picked that up.
Yeah, and I'm basically reading into the dissertation because in some of the lectures, and I'm unfortunately no longer online, but in some of the lectures at Harvard, when he's talking about this, he does say that they're, quote, epigenetically related, which means like developmentally related. So I think I'm reading in from extraneous materials.
So would you think that would be a one-way street where dependent self-esteem would be needed to develop independent self-esteem? Or both, kind of, they both feed off of each other?
Well, anybody want to add to that? That's a really good question. I don't know. If there's anybody who has any thoughts about this, you know, you can call in 646-727-3928 if you have any ideas. But the question is, does one have to come first? And basically, what I get so far is the validation of other people. The validation of other people is like developmentally significant. And Sandra and I have talked about attachment theory, I believe. Mm-hmm. And attachment theory shows that, and it's also, I guess you would consider it within positive psychology, because people are concerned with healthy attachments and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But in attachment theory, it's shown that a healthy relationship with another person actually fosters positive growth and fosters sort of the inner motivational resources that people need to flourish. I think it's a really interesting question. Like, if you don't have that external validation, so the question is, do you have to start out with, your idea of worth and competence for yourself? So competence in terms of what you know, okay, your idea of like what you can master. Do your ideas about your own mastery of something starts with somebody else telling you that you're good at something. So they have to start there. So your own ideas about your value, your worth as a person, have to start with other people. And, I mean, we're talking young people. We're talking children. So do you think that it's possible for a child who is never around somebody who acknowledges that child's worth and dignity as a human being, and also is not very successful in their environment, perhaps school, do you think that it's possible for that child to have self-esteem?
Yes, yeah, but I think that requires intrinsic motivation, and that's something that is innate in some people, not in all people, but...
Are you thinking of a particular example?
No, I'm not, but I think, I mean, but there are examples of people who do overcome the odds, and we like to make movies about those people and talk about them.
But is it because there's somebody else in their life?
Yeah.
I mean, is there somebody that comes along, like perhaps, you know, their family life is horrible? I mean, I'm thinking of Oprah Winfrey, okay? Her story is, I believe she was, like, raped when she was a child and horrible things. Mm-hmm. And she was, like, going to a high school that did, like, radio broadcasting.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how she started out. Like, and as a high school student, she was, like, doing radio shows. And she had this sort of natural rapport or this way of presenting that really captivated people. Mm-hmm. And it's like once she found that activity, maybe you don't need a person,
right.
But maybe there's, like, some activity. Mm-hmm. Anybody?
I think I heard something recently, and I don't remember where, about Bill Gates, that he happened to go to the only school that had computers at that point in that year, and he said, and that his point was part of his success was luck, and having, luck played a huge role in the fact that he came in contact with these things, and coming into contact with those things that foster that kind of growth.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there is the problem of the digital divide, and not everybody has a computer or access to the internet. But I think that the internet and the amount of information, and the fact that we're doing this right now, I mean, the internet allows people not only this huge library, but it allows people to find networks of people who are active. And so the internet has so much potential for being that, like, luck that you're talking about.
Yeah.
The problem is that I think a lot of young people view the internet as maybe like a social tool. Are young people, so do you guys agree? Like, do people, like, what do you guys think of the internet? I mean, how does that function in your life? Do you look at it as this thing that can expose you to activities, or is it just some, like, Facebook, or how is it functioning in your life?
When I started out with the computers and the internet specifically, I did use it as a resource, a social resource. You know, it was using internet messaging, you know, and back and forth between friends, and it was really nice because, you know, I could, you know, not have to, I could be talking to 10 people at a time and do it. So I liked it when I was younger, but now, I mean, it just helps out me to, you know, find resources, you know, to write a paper or anything like that. There's so much information that's right at your fingertips. I mean, watching the lectures that were on there, Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar's lectures were on there. It's just so cool how much stuff's out there.
Mm-hmm. So it did start out as like a social thing, and it's like evolving.
Correct.
It's evolving for you.
Yeah.
Okay, Emily, you've been kind of quiet.
I think I would agree. I think that this year in particular, I've been exposed more to, like, all the different things that the internet has to offer, like the lectures and this radio show, and you can really find something for anybody on there. So.
Okay, so, Sandra, do you want to say anything about the internet? And
I think, like anything else, it can be abused, and I think that's what happens oftentimes because, and it takes exposure. I think sometimes it takes somebody exposing the internet onlooker to something that might pique their interest.
Mm-hmm. And I can just say that I'm, like, consciously trying to do that in my classes by, like, having people do blogs and shows like this where I'm trying to show them the power of this resource. And it, quite frankly, you know, we're getting a bit off topic, but if we're going to wrap up the internet internet tangent and then go back to self-esteem. But, yeah, I think that part of the reason, or probably one of the main reasons why Barack Obama won, and he won by 52%, it was not a landslide victory, it was because his campaign was so tech-savvy. He was on Facebook, he was on Twitter. They're actually starting a technology office. They're going to create a new office in the White House, like Officer of Technology. And so they're aware of the power of it. So I think, education should actually take a conscious role because I think it can play a developmentally significant role. And if you're not exposed to the internet in that way, you're not going to realize the potential. And also how easy it is to, for example, broadcast this radio show. It's incredibly easy. Yeah. It's free. And everybody should do it. Okay, so going back to the question about, so does somebody need to be exposed to an activity or a person? Are we saying then that if there's not some person that's, whatever, validating somebody's worth as a human being, there needs to be some sort of luck? And what do you guys think?
I think this is a really difficult thought experiment because you just keep going back to, like, feral children that are completely isolated from everything. But I do agree that there has to be some sort of activity or person that steps in and sparks an interest in the least.
I like what you said, you know, sparks an interest, because this whole idea that we've talked about in other contexts, and I think it underlies what Paul is doing. Independent and dependent self-esteem, I think, are linked to the distinction between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation. Because if the only thing that's driving you is, you know, the so-called dependent self-esteem, what other people think of you, the external rewards, that sort of thing, that means that you're driven by external motivators. And I am persuaded that like complete flourishing and really being content, deeply content, it goes beyond that, and the person is driven by their own intrinsic needs, if you will, and the person needs to see themselves being driven by themselves. That has a very significant role in somebody's development. And so anybody want to add to that or have any thoughts?
I agree, and one of the things that I've been talking lately, getting into some dialogues about, has been about the public school system. And I also was talking with some friends from India, and I was wondering if the problem was any different over there, and it seems to be the same. But the problem being that nobody inherently enjoys going to school anymore. Or at least it doesn't seem to be that way. Maybe there is a few outliers that are enjoying it. But from the people that I've met, there's no inherent joy to go to school. And the primary reasons, especially in India, it's more prevalent that there are economic reasons of why they're going. To be able to survive, they have to go and do this thing. And it doesn't necessarily come from an internal desire other than the means to survive. And
Well, I mean, going back to what Emily said about somebody has to spark this thing, the whole idea behind intrinsic motivation is that we do have these intrinsic needs, desires, however you want to describe it, but one of them is for competence and learning, and that there is this, like, innate curiosity, and it needs to be cultivated. And there's this innate need for autonomy, and that needs to be cultivated. And the educational system is organized not to cultivate what are called inner motivational resources, but to sort of drive people by extrinsic motivators. So one interesting question, going back to your thing, you know, something has to spark. It sounds like there's like this potential. People, everybody has some sort of innate potential, but it takes something to sort of spark it, actualize it, and even if it's sparked, it then needs to be nurtured and cultivated and tended and cared for so that it grows. And if it grows long enough, something else takes over, which is this person's own intrinsic motivation. Does that make sense?
Right, I'd agree with that. Mm-hmm.
So we are saying then that I think what we're saying is that there needs to be some sort of external thing that comes to the person and stimulates, actualizes, what have you, something. You guys agree?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Do you want to say something? It's like you're... You know,
I guess I was thinking, because this kind of goes back to the dependent self-esteem idea being important in this developmental aspect,
mm-hmm.
and especially to socialization,
mm-hmm.
and being involved with the people around you.
Yes, I think that's an important part, because one of the things that Dr. Ben Shahar says that distinguishes his view of dependent versus independent self-esteem from others who make this distinction, like Desi and Ryan make this distinction between, I think they call it contingent and true self-esteem or something. And Desi and Ryan say that contingent, which is the same thing as dependent, self-esteem is bad. And Dr. Ben Shahar definitely disagrees with that. I think it's on page 25. I believe he says there's like a motivational, even if you're being motivated by external things, that motivation is a good thing. It propels the organism, it propels the human being. And let me also say, we're all like looking at, you who are listening may be wondering what we're doing. And what we're doing is we have Dr. Ben Shahar's dissertation in front of us. If you're interested in the dissertation, if you're a CMU student, you can get this for free. You want to go on to the CMU website and go to the library and then go into virtual reference desk. And when you click on that link, there'll be like an alphabetical index. You want to click on dissertations. That'll take you to the dissertation database, and you can get Dr. Ben Shahar's dissertation for free. If you're not affiliated with the university, I believe like UMI, which is Michigan, or ProQuest, I think it's probably like $40. But we're all looking, but...
I found a similar passage here where he definitely thinks that dependent what he says is, I mean to assign no negative connotation to either one of self-esteem's components. In and of itself, dependent self-esteem is not bad. For example, competition that is based on relative competence and hence caters to one's independent self-esteem can be an important and enjoyable source of motivation.
Yeah, so it has a motivational. I'm also looking on page 26. He says the same thing. Here he says, this is the very first full paragraph on page 26. He says, it's not possible to rid ourselves of the dependent element of self-esteem, and it is also not necessarily desirable. So it's like, that's why it's a necessary thing, and it's bad to get rid of it or because of its motivational power, but also because it gives somebody sort of like a touchstone. Like, there's this, you know, like going back to community, that there is some information that you're getting from other people. It sort of helps you stay on course. I don't mean to beat up on Michael Jackson, but a lot of people are critical of him because he's in a bubble and nobody, like, quote unquote, keeps it real with him. He doesn't have a board of beautiful enemies. And this dependent self-esteem can function as a sort of, this is a word that Dr. Ben Shahar uses, distal or sort of distant board of beautiful enemies. So you can have like a very close board of your significant others, and then you can have sort of society or community, and that is an important source of, I would say, motivation, but also information about sort of where you are. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I also like how he puts it. He says something like, the self cannot escape the self, where he's talking about how it's impossible to get away from this dependent self-esteem because if it's not coming from the society, eventually society standards get ingrained in ourselves. So even if there's nobody there criticizing us, the standards are still there. So.
Yeah, I think that's so powerful because there's the standards and where those come from, and there's also the value,
mm-hmm.
right? So like there's like standards of excellence, and I would say like if you're going to have a true standard of excellence, it's got to take into account the societal excellence, and your standard could actually be it could surpass it. But it can't totally ignore it. It has to acknowledge it because, quite frankly, we are inheritors of knowledge and wisdom. It's cumulative. There's a process. Human beings have contributed, and there is wisdom that exists. And one needs to take account of that in their own formulation of their standards. That's one thing, like where you get your standards, but also where you're getting your value from as well. Like, are you basing your own sense of worth on the fact that other people say you're awesome and you're complying with these standards? Or are you basing it on your own knowledge of yourself and what you know you're truly capable of, if that makes sense? Okay.
To go back to the next point about the public school system, one big issue I have with it is that it is so number-driven, and to an extent that's necessary, but at the same time it's not cultivating those things in students. It's not encouraging that this motivation needs to be from you, and this kind of self-worth is not in a number, it's in what you do, what are you doing, and how hard are you working, what are you contributing. So.
Yeah, I agree. What should be done about that, do you think?
I was going to ask the question, as a teacher, what do you think the role of the teacher is? Do you think it's through nurturing?
What do you think, I think?
Well, yeah, I think absolutely, but I want to...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that... I'm still learning
mm-hmm.
as a teacher, and I think I'll always be learning as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And... Yeah, it's sort of helping somebody along. There's we've talked about this idea of scaffolding, and not only do you have to sort of help people along and then sort of pull away and let people do their own thing, but I think also there's so many people who just don't even have like that inner belief that they can. I mean, I would say a lot of people don't even have dependent self-esteem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You guys agree?
Yeah.
A lot of people don't have dependent self-esteem.
Or they have, low self... There's not external... They don't have the external validation from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So there are people who, have no sense of worth coming from others.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel incompetent because they don't know how to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they know they don't know how to do anything. You disagree?
Oh, I guess I was just thinking that self-esteem could be it went into a negative spectrum of self-esteem, but maybe that takes on a whole different word if it goes into the negative realm.
Yeah, what do you want to call it? Suboptimal functioning.
I don't know. I guess I thought of it more of a continuum to, the bad and the good.
Yeah, let me, how much time do we have?
30.
Okay, we have 30 minutes. We have no callers, so... If you're listening, don't be shy. One thing that struck out, going about this, are there people who don't even have any senses, or they don't have the worth of both components? And I do want to, it struck me, page 14. Yeah. He's talking about William James.
Mm-hmm.
And William James, this is the second full paragraph, and he alludes to passages in William James where William James acknowledges both the worth element and the competence component of self-esteem. If you look at the very last sentence on page 14, elsewhere he alludes to the competence component of dependent self-esteem. I, who for the time have staked my all on being a psychologist, am mortified if others know much more psychology than I. So here you have William James, like his sense, the confidence component is coming from the kudos that he gets from other people. And just as a female, I think that if it was a woman who said this, like if a woman sort of ingratiated herself because, you know, I staked my whole on being this authority and I would feel mortified if somebody surpassed me in this domain. I just, it's strange to me because I think that for many women, like the competence component of self-esteem is like non-existent. And I wanted to also share a passage from On the Subjection of Women. This is from John Stuart Mill, where he basically acknowledges, I'm going to read, this is from chapter one of On the Subjection of Women. When we put together three things, first, the natural attraction between the opposite sexes, second, and by the way, this is written like a long time ago, but still, the institutions remain with us today. Mm-hmm. Second, the wife's entire dependence on the husband, I'm just going to skip over, every privilege or pleasure she has being either his gift or depending entirely on his will, that's not true anymore, obviously. And lastly, that the principal object of human pursuit, consideration, and all objects of social ambition for a woman can, in general, be sought or obtained by her only through him. It would be a miracle if the object of being attractive to men had not become the polar star of feminine education and formation of character. So in other words, and I think we're still there, okay, that like physical attraction is where like females are basing their self-esteem on. Like, and if you're not like physically attractive given the standards, you feel bad, but there's no competence component. Do you guys agree?
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Yeah. Okay? I just wanted to make that explicit. And I also wanted to also set up Lindsay Hyde's visit, because Lindsay Hyde, who works with Paul, has started a nonprofit called Strong Men, Strong Girls, which addresses the problem of self-esteem in girls. So she will be visiting the Ethics Center in April, and we'll definitely have a call-in show with her if you're interested in that. So, you know, put us on your friends list. keep your eyes open. Okay. So sort of off the tangent, but yeah.
Well, you asked Sandra, like, what do you do about the problem in public schools, or you know, with what's going on about you know, the central focus of it all? And I was thinking about this, and when I ran track in high school, one of the things that was always stressed to me by my coach was, you know, you're just trying to beat your own personal record. Mm-hmm. That's what you're trying to do, you know, and it stretches to like that. That was the mentality he would set up for you, and you know, I remember, you know, comparing myself to one of my buddies who's a phenomenal runner. I mean, runs a 4:27 mile. Kid's unbelievable. And just being really, you know, down on myself about it. And gradually I started to realize, you know, it's not about that. And once I started to do that, I ran my best quarter mile, which, you know, which was only 57, but it was great for me. And I think, you know, if you can somehow focus on people getting to their personal records, and it's a matter of your own sense that you establish these certain standards of yourself. So not a standardized test as much as a standard test for yourself.
And that's independent self-esteem.
Right.
Yeah. And so it's so interesting because, you know, you're a runner and you're developing a skill. And so, like, that aspect of your self-esteem is intact. I would consider that to be not only, that activity of running and track is nurturing the competence component, because you know that you have some skill, that you look out into the sea of people and you realize not everybody does that, okay? And also you had some success at it. So there's this activity that you have, right?
Yeah.
And what we were saying is, I think, like, for a lot of women, there's not that activity. And it's not even stressed, because the most important thing, I mean, still in many domains, not all domains whatsoever, but in many domains, that's like the most important thing. And there's so many messages, commercials, TV. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you guys feel that still today?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that needs to be dealt with. We have Lindsay Hyde doing it. but in any case, there needs to be work done there, big time.
So, yeah, having the activities to be done.
And it doesn't have to be athletic activities. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, Emily makes clocks. and that's kind of cool to make clocks.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. She makes clocks.
I've only made a few, so.
And, like, what got you into clock making? Like, how did that start out?
Well, it started out a couple months ago. I was visiting a friend up in northern Michigan, and she's an art major. And we were talking about how she does all this different art stuff, and I was like, you know what would be cool to make? It would be cool to make a clock, because I wanted one for my apartment, but all the clocks were, like, really expensive. So I started making these clocks, and I've only made a couple. So
totally intrinsic motivation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I just didn't want to spend the money on a clock, but then I realized that it was kind of cool to make these clocks, and I've given them out as gifts, and... You know.
Do you make, like, the wheels inside
and stuff?
The
gears.
No, I just buy the part.
Oh. Yeah.
And that would be kind of cool, though.
That's really sweet.
Oh, this is, like, people who make computers.
Yeah.
There's actually a guy down the hall.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into him, Andrew. And he knows how to make a computer. And that just sounds so cool, those guys know how to make a computer. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really not that hard because they make all of, you know, the circuits or whatever.
It's just
a matter of, like, putting this piece there and then... it's not a big deal. But so these activities, and going back to education, it's like education doesn't really seem to be focused on teaching people activities. It's like sitting there, you're teaching somebody to take a test.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, going back to that point. I did want to connect this with academic integrity, because that's in our title. Do you guys want to say anything about that? How dependent, independent, self-esteem relate to academic integrity? And I hate the word academic integrity, by the way, but...
Why don't you like that word? Or the phrase?
Why don't I like it? I just think it conjures up sort of like a policing and, you know, don't cheat, and sort of like some punitive, meaning like punishment, and I like to approach the whole issue by acknowledging that people have an innate desire to know.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a need, I would say. You have an innate need for competence, and the problem is that innate need has not been properly stimulated, cultivated, nurtured, and that's why we have academic dishonesty. Like, there's something else driving the person.
Mm-hmm.
They're not driven by their own innate needs. They're driven by some other bizarre worldview. But that's why I don't like the word. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
do you like the word?
Or
the term?
I don't have a particular, like, against it, but...
You're neutral?
Yeah. But I thought what you were saying about it related to independent, the problem with self-esteem. And if you base your, if you're a highly dependent self-esteem type of person, you're more likely, I think, to fall into an academic dishonest pursuit to increase your self-worth, because you want your self-esteem to be higher. And so if you're comparing yourself to others, then if you do well, you know, because you cheat, then you still get that gratification because other people look at you.
I don't think you do. I think you feel like crap.
I think it'll hurt your self-esteem even more.
Yeah.
I mean, I
agree, but when you have when you have that focus on that dependent self-esteem, you tend to want to try to fix that, and you want to have that. So I guess that's what I was getting at, not trying to say that you get some... You know, it feels like a good thing to do it, more so that you strive to do it with the dependent.
But actually, I mean, I acknowledge the validity of the point that you'll feel bad. But on the other hand, given the rampant cynicism and the attitude that people have about education, that it's just a means to get a job, and you could think I'm just really clever, okay? There could be some people who are like, I quote-unquote buck the system or whatever. Now, I don't quite frankly believe that because of what I said before, which is that people have an innate desire or innate need for competence. And when that innate need is not fulfilled, suboptimal existence exists. And you're robbing yourself of the very thing that you need when you engage in acts of academic dishonesty. And I also think you will feel bad at some level. Actually, I remember having this debate with somebody, not about academic integrity, but just sort of morality in general. And the debate was with a priest that I met on the train. I was going to D.C. to actually attend the 9/11 hearings. And there was actually it was a pastoral counselor, I should say. And he had, like, just come back from Africa, and we were talking about what motivates people, and he basically, I was coming out with this idealistic view that at some level they know it's wrong, and he's like, no, they don't. No, they don't. They don't feel bad. They don't feel guilty. And I think that's, you know, just an interesting question. But according to self-determination theory, which I'm very influenced by, there are these innate needs for competence, autonomy, and relatedness. And if they're not fulfilled, you're not going to have a flourishing human being. Anything else on academic integrity and self-esteem?
I think the example that Nick was giving where you cheat and you get away with it and you still feel really good about yourself, I think that goes back to Tal Ben-Shahar saying that dependent and independent self-esteem can be in conflict with each other, mm-hmm. where if you get away with it, your dependent self-esteem is really high, but deep down inside, your independent self-esteem is suboptimal, mm-hmm. and you just feel like there's nothing going on with you. But people just keep saying you're doing great, so you're one side of you is up, but mm-hmm. the other side isn't. So.
Yeah, I think a really, you know, interesting point here with independent self-esteem is there's, like, obviously some sort of inner voice. We call it consciousness, or, like, the conscience. There's some, like, inner voice. And, you know, this whole idea, like, you're not really fooling anybody. Because in the end, you have to, you know, you're going to live a life, and you're going to, like, see yourself, or you're going to judge what you did with your life, and it's just you and yourself, and you can't fool. Like, you see what you do. You know what you do. And there's something there that I think that you're getting at. There's this other thing. It's not just all what other people think of us. But yeah, I didn't really pick up on the idea about the relationship, like the conflict thing that you're talking about. That's really interesting and important. What about you guys?
Well, also with dependent self-esteem, one of the first things brought up in it that Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar brings up.
Let's just call him Tal.
All right, we're just going to call him Tal now.
It's easier.
What I've been
not
doing.
Because we don't, you know, totally respect him, because we do. But it's just easier for us to say it, so go ahead.
But one of the problems with the literature of self-esteem was that it was highly focused on the dependent self-esteem side.
Mm-hmm.
But it was strange that a lot of highly dependent self-esteem people who were praised by their friends and family and people that are notable to them did not have high levels of self-worth. And I also think, you know, that if you imagine that you're cheating, you know, and you're getting all this praise from people, and you're like, yes, this is what I was trying to go after, and then realizing just how unhappy you are, and then having to tell yourself, wow, I am completely incompetent now. You know, I don't know what I just graduated college, going on to do this job now, and now I'm going to be with all these other people. Like, what now? More cheating? You know?
Mm. Yeah. What do you think happens?
Hopefully,
you think that people
some
self-discovery.
Hopefully some self-discovery, you know? One of the things in the lectures that Tal would say was never let a good failure go to waste, you know. And so if you really, really screw up, like, allow that to be internalized and turn it into a success. Make it something that you can create better habits from, you know, a changing point.
I think the deeper you get into that, the harder it is to get out. I'm distantly related to someone who did cheat his way through college, and now he works for the post office sorting mail, and he's not happy. But, I mean, but he never learned. He never, he still brags that he made his way through college with cheating, so.
Maybe he hasn't encountered the right activity or the right person. I mean, do you guys have any ideas or theories about why that is, why he's still...
I think there's an internal resistance within certain people like that. Like, he could encounter the right person or could have encountered the right person, but if he's not willing to see that he needs to change or that his behavior is not promoting flourishing, then...
Where does that come from?
Well, I mean, it's scary to admit that you're a failure, I mean, or that you failed at something. That's terrifying.
Yeah. But then again, like, that's usually what moves you forward, is once you can admit it. I mean, isn't that the 12-step program or something?
Yeah,
I think most people know that. It's
right.
Just,
yeah.
It's
hard.
It's still really hard.
Yeah.
So.
Actually, I think one of the reasons why it's so hard is because we don't realize that everybody's doing it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with knowledge and Socrates. Like, Socrates would go around and point out that people are ignorant, okay? But it's not like Socrates believed he was higher on the totem pole. We're all the same. We're all in the same boat. We're all morons. I mean, okay, we're all in the same boat. And so we think that, like, people feel bad when he would expose their ignorance because they thought that he knew something they didn't. And I think it's the same thing with failure, because we think that, like, all we see is the success. Paul definitely makes this point. All you see is the success. You're not aware of the person. So let's just mention Barack Obama, who ran for Congress. He ran for Congress and he lost. And I'm sure there are opportunities in his development, if you will, where he could have. I mean, he graduated magna cum laude, not summa cum laude. Okay? So there were times where he didn't get an A. Okay. There are times when I haven't gotten an A. I'll confess my failures. And there are opportunities for him to be like, it's just because I'm a black man and they're racist. But he obviously didn't do that. Okay. He had the opportunity, but he did not. And I think what we don't realize is that people who do become successful all experience these failures, but their attitude towards them is one that says, I'm going to use it in this healthy way, or I'm not going to be pulled down by this sort of description. So it's like this idea of what you say to yourself when you fail and picking yourself back up. Like, I want to know what Barack Obama said to himself when he didn't get the A in law school, when, you know, there had to have been moments, okay, when he lost Congress, okay, when he had an idea and it didn't work out. Okay, I want to know what he said to himself. That is the stuff that we don't know. And I think, like, if we were all explicit about that, that it would be easier for us. And there's also a trust thing. Like, if when you reveal your failures, you're sort of like putting your guard down. And I think, like, when you do that, when you're, like, the first one to do that, like, other people will reciprocate.
Yeah.
But somebody has to be the first one to do it.
Yeah.
On a smaller scale, I did this construction job. I've been doing it for two years now. I've done it two summers and two winters now. And I was probably I've never felt more incompetent at anything in my entire life. I mean, and these guys are hard, brute, bigots. I mean, they're not very nice people. And, you know, we're out of Howell, a pretty racist area. They're pretty racist. But it was interesting, I mean, seeing these old guys who worked incredibly hard and trying to pick up from them some of the skills, and they're very short with you about what they're explaining, and it's, you know, one word answers, and really trying to pick up from that. And at the end of the day, getting no praise. Nobody says, hey, good job, you know. They're just like, hey, you better be here tomorrow, you know. Like, okay, dude, I'll be here, you know.
I think that's a matter of their own insecurities.
I don't think so. Those guys are, maybe a couple of them, but I know some of them are very confident. And I'm not sure, maybe deep down they have insecurities.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Yeah.
But either way, like, not to try to make judgments on their character, the point of what I was trying to get from that is that when I would come back to this, I would keep asking myself when I first started back up again and trying to get familiar with it, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Why am I back here again? Like, this is so hard, and I could probably do another job and get paid just, you know, closely to the same amount. And I realized it was about when I came out of that experience, realizing how I felt, like, each time I came back, I felt more confident, for one. Mm-hmm. And that increased my level of independent, because I had to make it independent. Everybody around me knows what they're doing, you know, and is good at it, and I'm not good. And so I have to really try to tell myself, this is just me here. You focus on what you're doing. Don't worry about how good they are at carpentry. Mm-hmm. And I end up coming back, you know, and coming to school, and it's very, it cultivates, I think, a sense of independent self-esteem, and it feels good to do that. And you also find yourself more conscious of comparing yourself to others. You know, even in my successes at times, I remember, and I still do this, I think, sometimes, where I would succeed, and I would look at the other people around me to see who didn't, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a strange thing, and I'm like, wow, why is that the focus, mm-hmm. you know? And so being able to ask yourself these questions and to step away from the situation, I think, mm-hmm. is really important.
Do you think that going back to your experience with running, okay, it just, like, when I hear you tell the story about the carpentry and whatnot, that, like, the die has been cast, if you will. Like, you had learned the lesson in running, like, about, it's not about this other thing, it's about setting my own personal goal.
Yeah.
Have you consciously or subconsciously, do you see a connection? Do you see, you know, sort of, like, the lesson that you learned when you were running being carried over into this domain? Or am I totally off base thinking that there's a connection there?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, because running was a challenge for me. I didn't want to go to practice. And, you know, after pushing myself for a while, it became easier. Just as, you know, the end of winter, like, doing the work, you know, I was like, well, it's time to go back up to school. It wasn't so terrible, you know, anymore.
I
didn't really answer your question, did I?
No, I'll ask it again. So were you, you said your coach said you want to strive for your own personal, what was it that you said?
Personal record, your PR.
Right. So, I mean, did you internalize that, right?
Yeah. I mean, like you said, consciously or subconsciously, either way, I mean, I ended up coming to this same conclusion, you know, and I didn't think about my running while I was there, you know what I mean?
I think it's totally there.
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys agree, disagree?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I mean, I think that experience is a powerful lesson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's a nice argument for, like, why sport is very important, why, like, a good coach in sport mm-hmm. is very important, because, like, that's a lesson mm-hmm. that will serve you well.
Yeah.
Have you guys played sports?
I ran track too. I'm not a runner, but I will tell a story though. There was one, I was so bad that in one event I was like in like the fourth or fifth heat, and I was the only one running, and I told my coach, I'm the only one running. He's like, all right, do it. And so I ran, and I even like tripped. I started, got up, like kept going, got to the end, turned around, looked at my coach after a whole season of like failure. I go, I won! And he told the story at the banquet, like so proud. But once he realized that like that was my personal best was not going to be like the winner, like I wasn't gonna win for the team, but I mean, I was working hard, and it was a similar thing. Like, I did get to a point where I was like, wow, I didn't think I could ever, you know, run 5 miles and, you know, feel. So, yeah, it's a good experience.
And, yeah, again, go ahead.
No.
Yeah, again, that mm-hmm. call, I think that does call, like, we were talking about having activities, and
mm-hmm.
there is a really, you know, because I was talking about how it should be enjoyable to go to school and to do, you know, I think public education needs to put more joy, and now I'm kind of thinking, like, there has to be struggle, too, and there has to be failure, and it has to be hard at times,
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, you know, I think that's also true in life, that it's not always going to be easy, and things aren't always going to work out, you know, and
yeah.
So I think that preparation of being kind of, not coerced, but challenged to a real extent.
And with education, I think that we often, because we're so number-based with test scores and grades and the competition that occurs there, I think we undermine the ability that failure has to really, like, promote self-esteem in a roundabout way. I mean, it really is. It's like the starting point. And that's like where you get up and you trip, and then you get back up and you finish. But it really is a useful tool if it's presented in the right kind of spirit or light.
Yeah, actually, the research in self-determination theory and, like, motivation theory, there's a concept called failure-forgiving classrooms. And so there are classrooms that are organized to promote failure, but when it happens, there's not people don't feel bad. It's encouraged so that people actually, like, take greater risks and feel okay when they fail. And I think that it's because we are so focused on the external and presenting a certain public face, that there's all this other stuff going on that's really, I think, crucial for success, that we don't realize that everybody fails. Anybody else want to? Are you thinking something?
I was thinking about I can't remember. I think it's called The Question of Happiness, Pleasure, Meaning, and the Ultimate Currency. I probably screwed up that.
That's Paul's first book.
Right. Well, I remember he talks about a parable in it about a man who, through all his life, I don't even remember exactly how he puts it, but basically this guy's anything he asks for, he gets. And he keeps asking for all these things and getting them and getting them and getting them. And then he says, well, I want to work for something right now. And he says, you know, like, just challenge me, do something. And the guy says, I can't, you know. And the whole thing was that he was actually in hell when he was thinking that he was in heaven. And he's like, no, you know, like, I guess, you know, the flames go up. He doesn't have any source of challenge.
Right.
And so, I mean, I wonder if you could use that as a motivating force where it's like, you know, you've heard in, like, Office Space, the guy doesn't want to do anything. And it's like to really put somebody up to that task, like, okay, go ahead, do nothing. You know what I mean? And see how that responds actually in long term ends up being an influence, you know, either, hey, wow, that was horrible, or if somebody can really just go on doing nothing.
Well, going back to Mihai Csikszentmihalyi and the whole idea of flow and optimal experience, what he argues, and this is based on empirical research, is that, like, optimal functioning is the right balance between, there must be challenge, but there also must be skill. So it's like the ideal engagement. It's the thing that engages your whole being, but it also pushes you. And when you're pushed, you're inevitably going to fail. But you perfect something by failing, getting back up, doing it again. I just think about the people who do those, like, skateboarding maneuvers, and there's some, like, people are breaking bones when they're figuring this stuff out, how to do this stuff, and they're just keep doing it.
Yeah, hours on end.
But I think we're running out of time. We have 1 minute remaining. Does anybody want to have any final thing to say, or just leave it at that? It's a conversation that will continue, that will, you know, influence our other conversations. Sure.
If you're listening, we encourage calling in. That would be excellent to have a guest caller.
Yeah, or, you know, kind of lonely over here. And we have this, you know, really fancy setup that allows us to take 5 calls. So there could, at, like, maximum, there can be 9 people. There could be 9 people engaged in a conversation. Today there was 4. So have a great evening. Say goodbye. Bye.
Well, goodbye.
Thank you for listening.
Have a great night.
And talk to you soon. Take care.